rush through the throng and through the crush, do you hear in the hush of your soul, of your soul? We have heard some of your questions, some of the questions that you have posed to us this morning, and all of you, all of us, often have questions in our hearts, in our souls, in our spirits, and questions that we feel as a human community sharing this earth together. And so as I invite Chris Cook to come forward and kindle the flame of our chalice this morning, I'm going to say that our flame this morning is the flame of inquiry. It's the light of questions, the light of seeking, the light of hope in the midst of all of the uncertainty and tumult of our world. Come, let us gather around this light. Come, let us gather as we seek.
I see you. Questions and answers. A man I knew long ago labeled my aunt the interrogator, because whenever he was in her company, she was always asking him personal questions. I have also been labeled the interrogator by a friend of recent times. Again, too many personal questions. Upon reflection, I realize a few things. I grew up in a very connected, familiar environment. To us, this meant that we knew much of each other's history. The pace of our lives was such that we spent much time in each other's company, and like the indigenous people in the movie Avatar, we could look into each other's eyes and honestly offer the reassurance, I see you. Our questions come from the intention of being deeply connected to you, knowing you. And our answers to your questions are rooted in the belief that you want to know each of us. So much happens in this kind of questioning and answering. Similarly, 1,000 years ago, I was driving home with our little family. It was very late at night. My husband of that time was asleep, and my stepson, a boy of perhaps 8 or 10, offered me an invitation. Tell me about your olden days. I was 23. And so we ask questions, listening for the answers that help us to see each other.
Now you can think of Krista Tippett or Oprah Winfrey or Barbara Walters, whoever works for you. Reverend Shauna and Melora have asked me to voice your questions. So many interesting questions. In our time this morning, they can't respond to all of them, but will do their best to answer as many as they can. Also, as was noted in the newsletter, in order to fit in as many questions as possible, they won't both answer the same question. Reverend Shauna, recently Dan Klimke delivered a homily entitled, Oh Hell. Here are 6 questions related to that service.
It's a light start.
What are we to make of the opposite concept, that of heaven? What is its origin? When did this idea get started? Is there anything about it in the scriptures? Does modern science get in the way? Do humans need rewards to change their behavior?
So I'm starting my 2-minute answer now. Obviously, I'm not going to go deeply into the origins or all of the questions that were just posed, but the notion of heaven is an interesting one, and it does go back. I was doing a little bit of research. Some writing about it goes all the way back to Beowulf, for those of you familiar with that, writing from 725, And the word heaven itself just simply means sky or firmament, the place where God dwells. Now, of course, we could get into whether the place where God dwells has to be a transcendent location, right? Then we've got into all this God being up in some far-off location. And there is some scriptural reference in 1 Corinthians 13 and other places, but 1 Corinthians talks about Paul, St. Paul talks about seeing heaven only dimly in this life, but seeing heaven face to face after we die. So to get to all of these little bits, I'm going to kind of rush through, but does science get in the way? Yes, if what you need is a concrete, actual place that is heaven, that's proven, because there is no proof that heaven exists. The last part of the question was, do we need rewards to behave? And my answer to that question is no. No more than we need threats to behave. No more than we need the notion of hell in order to behave. We behave because life is better that way. So humanist notions would be that we're good for the sake of goodness itself. Theists would say we're good because that's what God has made us for. That's what we were intended to do and to be, that was God's vision for me. And lastly, I would say rather than heaven, what I prefer is the notion of a kingdom, of God's kingdom. I've always liked this notion of the kingdom, or as you've heard me say it before, the kingdom, which is a place where God's family, the human community, is whole and reconciled. That's what they say at one of the churches, UU churches that I was a part of. This vision of beloved community, all souls, is the place where the human family is whole and reconciled. And to me, that would be heavenly.
Thank you, Reverend Shauna. And now, Reverend Melora, a congregant, says, I'm struggling with how to stay positive in such a sad world. I often feel torn between feeling I am burying my head in the sand, feeling useless, and just meditating to try to hold on to my serenity. Then in contrast, when I'm exposed to a lot of negative media, I find myself overly focusing on the problems of the world. I get depressed, and I don't want to be a part of it. I don't want to walk around angry or so sad that I can't appreciate the beauty that does exist. How do you find hope?
Yeah, that's a hard one. I think many of us grapple with that same tension. Horrible things happen in our world. It can indeed be overwhelming, make you want to curl up in a ball of withdrawal. One of the things that I've learned from social activists like Joanna Macy is that there is sometimes strength to be found in sitting with the sadness. We cry when we hear of these terrible things because we care. And there is great power in that caring, especially when we connect with others who also care. Joanna Macy has designed rituals and workshops that help social activists voice their emotions, their sadness, anger, fear, and longing. I've led a couple of those rituals here. What usually happens is that in sharing these feelings with others who also feel them deeply, there's a kind of a release. You are held by others as you share your despair, and in turn, you hold them as they share theirs. Holding the hard stuff together generates a kind of a salve. It's not a Pollyanna, everything will be okay now, but you feel less alone. You feel how others care for you, how you care for them, how you all care together for the larger whole. It has the effect of renewing your sense of resiliency, your willingness to keep on keeping on, doing your little part toward the greater good. I've learned, too, that social activists need to intentionally keep refilling their wells. We have to do those things that feed us. Walk in the woods, meditate, pet a cat, laugh with friends. When we make a habit of seeking out the things that lift our spirits and feed our souls, we are better able to maintain the strength we need to tend to the broken parts of our world. It's a balancing act for sure, replenishing the well, caring for the world. I've preached whole sermons on this challenge. Check out our Facebook group for two of them, links to two of them. For now, I will end with those well-loved words by Wendell Berry that are in our hymnal, number 483. When despair for the world grows in me, and I wake in the night at the least sound, in fear of what my life and my children's lives may be, I go and lie down where the wood drake rests in his beauty on the water and the great heron feeds. I come into the peace of wild things who do not tax their minds with forethought of grief. I come into the presence of still water, and I feel above me the day-blind stars waiting with their light. For a time, I rest in the grace of the world and am free. So may it be for all of us.
Thank you, Reverend Melora. Reverend Shauna, please respond to the following. At the last new member ceremony, when I read and heard that the new members wanted to be a part of something bigger than themselves, I cringed, because I value freedom of belief and believe this is compromised with this statement. Where the beep, beep, beep did this come from? And how do I get it out of the system?
Well, some of you, Maria said to me this morning that some of you read the piece that I wrote for the Times Colonist, which was in the paper yesterday. And I just wrote about my sadness and my lament over the loss of two things that I think address this question, which are two virtues that I think used to be lifted up a lot more than they are now. And those two virtues are humility and a sense of interdependence. And I think in our modern world, we've kind of lost sight of those two things. And so I think we are a part of something larger than ourselves, whether we like it or not. I think it's scientifically fact that we're part of something larger than ourselves, whether you want to term that the universe, whether you want to call that the ecosystem, whether you call that the web of life, whether you look at your own particular being and see yourself as part of a family or part of a neighborhood or part of a community, part of the human community. How far you take that something larger than yourself depends on your theology and your belief system and your values, so you may not see it as part of something larger in the sense of something supernatural. But I think it's just true that we are interconnected, we are interdependent, and I think, and I'm really worried right now in our world, that we're diminished by how much we resist being part of an interconnected something that's larger than us. We end up, I think, when we're focused too much on our own egos and our own individual, what I get, what's in it for me, we end up too separate and too apart and seeing ourselves as somehow above or different from or special. It's kind of like in our drive to be special and unique, we lose the fact that so's everybody else. And we're in this together. So I hope that humility and interdependence will make a comeback, because I think we are all part of something bigger than ourselves.
Reverend Melora, what does prayer mean in a Unitarian context? Christian prayer often seems based on asking for something, giving thanks or praise. Though I never really believed in asking for something, I do miss the idea of prayer. Is there a Unitarian version?
Yes. Well, more accurately, there are many different Unitarian versions of prayer. Following up on what Reverend Shauna just said, Unitarian Universalist prayer, or meditation for that matter, is often about opening ourselves up to feel our interconnection with something larger than ourselves, be it the web of life or human community or some kind of spirit of life or power of love that connects us all. Like the questioner indicated, most UUs don't tend to do the ask for something kind of prayer. However, we might use prayer to verbalize a desire to change something internal. Like setting your goals or stating your intentions, sometimes saying it in words helps bring it into being. Source of compassion, help me be patient with this person. Spirit of life and love, may I find the strength I need to get through this really hard time. One of my favorite forms of Unitarian prayer is song. The questioner mentioned praise and gratitude as being powerful components of prayer. We have not given that up. We still have For the Beauty of the Earth, hymn number 21. Instead of Lord of all, we say Source of all. Source of all, to thee we raise this our hymn of grateful praise. There's also 175, We Celebrate the Web of Life. And that one from the teal hymnal, Oh, we give thanks for this precious day. One of our most beloved Unitarian hymns, Spirit of Life, works really well as a prayer. The other thing we do in prayer is hold one another in love. Some of my most moving prayer experiences have been with other UU ministers in small group check-ins. In a group of three or four, each has a turn to share, for example, something with which they are struggling. The others listen with full loving attention and then offer words of prayer. Spirit of life and love, we hear that so-and-so is struggling with such-and-such. They are working so hard. As they sort through it all, may they find what they need, clarity, humor, grace. May they remember, too, that they are held in love by this group of colleagues, by their family at home, by friends far and near. There's something about it that feels more healing than a regular conversation. UUs can get caught up in the question of whether something is out there listening to our prayers and whether we address our prayers to someone or something. That question is not terribly important to me. Whether you are using meditation to breathe in peace and breathe out love, or whether you envision yourself talking to some sort of person-like spirit, what seems most important to me is how it affects you. When you use prayer or meditation to express gratitude, to hold those you care for in love, to focus on what you need to get you through your struggles, how does prayer or meditation help prepare you to walk in the world as the self that you long to be?
I'm back. What will our faith look like in 20 years? What will attract young adults? Where and how will we meet and or connect? Reverend Shauna?
Well, I wish I had a crystal ball. I don't, but I have some inklings about what Unitarian Universalism might look like in 20 years. I can be pretty sure that it won't look like what it looks like today. As you know, the landscape of not only Protestantism writ large, but religion writ large, especially in North America, is dwindling. And Unitarian Universalism, while it hasn't been dwindling precipitously, has been pretty flat in its membership for the last several decades. So I think Unitarian Universalism is now recognizing that it needs to be more open to change than it has been in the past. There's been a lot of conversation lately about what the UUA president called congregations and beyond, that there won't just be congregations anymore. There will be new kinds of communities that are going to be Unitarian Universalist, in at least in spirit, if not explicitly so. And some of those communities already exist. So I think that points the way toward what Unitarian Universalism will look like in 20 years. There's a group in Boston called The Sanctuary. Young adult guy who was a Harvard Divinity student decided none of the UU churches were a little too staid, a little too tight for him. So he started a whole new community that started meeting at First and Second Church in Boston, singing pop songs as part of the worship, lots of kind of crazy music, very animated, very emotional, very different from a lot of our congregations. There's another group that started in Washington, D.C. called the Sanctuaries. I kind of confuse them occasionally. But that's just a community specifically of artists, of written word, of visual artists, of artists coming together around a spiritual purpose, and musicians as well. They've put out a CD, and that was started by a UU minister. And there's another one that I looked up for this morning called Mutual Aid Carborough, which is in the Chapel Hill, North Carolina area. A young man minister who started that. He also calls it Sacred Fire Unitarian Universalism. And their tagline is building community through interdependence and solidarity work. And it's mostly a young adult community that does a lot of like action in their community together, as well as community building. So I think a lot of new forms are going to take place. I think a lot of our old forms of meeting and gathering are going to take on new things. If you like scriptural references, it's kind of like the wineskins. We're going to need some new wineskins. And if you've seen, another last thing I'll mention is there's a wonderful crowdfunding website that got started by a couple of UU folks who thought we needed something, and it's called Faithify. And you go on their website homepage and you just get inspired looking at it, because it's a lot of people contributing to all of these efforts at starting everything from like one thing that was on there was like UU videos, kind of like TED Talks. Somebody was wanting to start UU Talks, and they got a bunch of people to chip in $25 and they're starting it for $3,000. So there are all kinds of new things that are already rolling, and I think that's the kind of thing, that's where we're headed.
Reverend Melora, I hear that we're going to have a half-time interim minister this year and next year. Who is he, and what does it mean for a congregation to have an interim minister?
An internship is one of the many requirements a person has to complete to become a Unitarian Universalist minister. Our intern's name is Chris Wolfe. He is a fifth-generation Canadian Unitarian. He has just graduated from Emmanuel College in Toronto with a Master's of Divinity degree. Chris has an impressive resume packed with lots of computer communications jobs with nonprofits, as well as tons of UU experience, including serving as a congregational president, a lay chaplain, a UU leadership school facilitator, a youth advisor, and a member of numerous denominational committees. It has been an eventful year for Chris, as you may have heard. In addition to completing his MDiv, he recently just got married and had a baby. Chris begins work with us on September 6th. We will get a chance to welcome their whole family, Chris, Ariel, and 5-month-old Rowan, on In-Gathering Sunday, September 11th. This congregation has had interns before. Some of you will recall that being a teaching congregation means simply that we agree to be a place where an intern can practice and hone their ministerial skills. I will be his supervisor in the first year. Shauna will supervise second year. During our four-month sabbatical next spring, we're so excited about this, the very experienced Reverend Deborah Falk will be his off-site supervisor. She's in Calgary. She's awesome. Chris will also receive support and guidance from an intern committee made up of members of this congregation. Chris will spend his first month or so attending various meetings and events, getting to know our system and our people. During that time, he and I and the intern committee will work out a learning serving agreement, which will specify the areas of ministry on which he wishes to focus. He's already scheduled to preach his first sermon on October 30th. Reverend Sean and I are really excited about the new ideas and perspectives that his ministry will bring to this congregation.
Reverend Shauna, having served this congregation for a few years now, what has been the most rewarding part of your service to the congregation? In what have you been disappointed? And what advice do you have for congregants that would be helpful to their spiritual growth?
Another short two minute question. The rewarding aspect, so the question is really three questions: rewarding, disappointing, and spiritual growth. And the rewarding, I could take the broad view and say why I love being a minister, because I do love being a minister. I think I have a great job, if not the best job, because it's a vocation that fits me personally very well. But I think the person was getting at more specifically, what have I really enjoyed about the last 6 years here with you all? And there's a lot of different things. I was thinking back through and I thought, wow, you know, I've really loved being a part of the pageants that we had and hanging out with the kids and working on those. I've really enjoyed, I guess it probably shows since I helped start the Jazz Vespers series. I've really enjoyed, which actually brings me to how much I've really enjoyed collaborating with a lot of the leaders in the congregation to just sort of try new things and just try some new things out. So I found that really rewarding, the kind of sense of experimentation and trying some new things. That's been what's been really rewarding. Disappointing. I think the one thing, when we first came back from break, we got an email from someone telling us that there was someone who had visited a number of times and never really made any connections here. And so they ended up kind of going to Capitol. And that was kind of sad to me, because I've heard that a couple of different times, that we'll have newcomers come and then they kind of hang out in coffee hour and they grab the colorful mug or whatever and they don't make connections. And it kind of surprises me, because I feel like you guys are a really warm bunch and nice and open. But I think sometimes you guys get into business mode during coffee hour and you seek out the person you need to talk to about something. And so just it's a little disappointment, but I think something for us all to keep an eye on is how well are we welcoming new people and not just doing the things that we normally do. And the last piece of the question was about spiritual growth. And my biggest advice about spiritual growth is practice. Practice. In a word, practice, which, you know, do as I say, not as I do. That's what the sabbatical's for. I'm going to get into practicing again. But take some time each day to do something that helps you get in touch with the big picture of your existence. Whether that's the big picture of your sense of what's meaningful, the big picture of where your sense of purpose or calling is. But that's my biggest piece of advice. Take some time every day to get in touch with what really matters to you.
Here's another interesting question for you, Reverend Melora. What are your thoughts about disposing of your remains? Buried? Are you going in the ground? Cremated? Sky burial?
Sky burial? I had to look that up. I did. It's the one where you put the body on top of the mountain and leave it there to decompose, helped along by weather and scavenging animals. It is a tradition common to places like Tibet, Mongolia, and Nepal, though other peoples have used similar methods all over the world. I can see the poetry in that, giving your body back to the interdependent web of life from whence it came. But I'd have to figure out a way to get past my totally irrational negative reaction to the idea of vultures picking at my body. When I was younger, I was only aware of two options, burial and cremation. I used to think that I wanted to be cremated. I generally believe that when I die, the self I think of as me will no longer be in my body. I will likely cease to exist entirely. But even if some part of my spirit joins with some sort of spiritual oversoul or some such, I'm still thinking that my body will just be an empty shell. So it doesn't really matter to me what happens to my body. Cremation seemed to be the most efficient way to dispose of it, ashes to ashes and all that. I say I used to think that I wanted to be cremated. But then when I was in my 20s, I went to the funeral of my grandfather's second wife, Anne, whom I had known as a grandmother figure. I was glad to be able to attend the funeral to honor Anne and to share memories with the others who had loved her. I was also glad to be there because when my grandfather had died several years earlier, I had not been able to attend his funeral. I loved my granddad, my father's father, so for me, this journey was about saying goodbye to him as well. Wait, there it is. Okay, thank you. I had been thinking that when we attended the graveside service, I would see my granddad's grave next to Anne's. There was something oddly comforting to me about picturing the two of them together side by side. But when we got there, I learned that both of them had been cremated. We were at the cemetery to intern their ashes. I had the oddest reaction. I felt like he had been taken away. Like something inside me protested, but where is he? I knew it wasn't logical, and my reaction surprised me. It made me realize that there was something in me that wanted the body as an anchor, a place to direct my expressions of loss and love. Somehow, a little box of ashes just didn't seem a substantial enough anchor. I still don't really care what happens to my body when I die, but I understand now how much it might matter to those who are left behind. So I am open to whatever my family chooses. I am happy to have my ashes in an urn that they can take with them when they move from home to home, or scattered in some natural place that they like to frequent. If they want a grave to visit, I'm fine having my body buried, preferably with a green burial. But no vultures, please.
Reverend Shauna, what work do you do to further integrate into this Canadian culture? What does that process feel like?
I was glad to get this question because I feel like it gave me a chance to address something that I didn't do last week. I wasn't completely happy with my sermon last week. I'll just let you know that. And part of it was because I didn't think I talked enough about sort of the U.S.-Canada thing. It was kind of the elephant in the room around Black Lives Matter, was it not? And then I didn't really go there because I think I have a little bit of uncomfortable stuff to say about Canada around this. So I'm going to go there a little bit right now in my 2 minutes. Is that okay? All right? So here's what I think. I think that the world community has every right to think that the U.S. and Americans are myopic and too focused on themselves. They think they're too self-important. I get it, and I completely agree as an American who tried all the time to travel a lot and see other things. And I do think of myself still as an American who lives in Canada. You guys remind me of that all the time, okay? So that's all true, okay? That's just all given. Whenever you hear me say that, like, I get the criticism of the U.S., and I think it's right, okay? The other thing that is true is I also think it's true that Canadians are rightfully proud of the social safety net that you have here and the values that the Canadian government and culture has around multiculturalism as a value. I really love the image of the mosaic. And I think that Canada has so much to be proud of in terms of the high quality of life index and the, you know, like there was just one of those most livable cities in the world indices came out, and in the top 10, Canada had 3 cities, okay? So good job, right? And I'm always happy to return to Canada. There's a funny kind of the way Melora talks about that little, like, you know, what she was just, I have this thing, like a visceral thing when we get off the plane in Victoria and I see the welcome to Canada and stuff, I'm like, it's nice to be back. So there's a big piece of me that's just happy to be here. And I think Canada still has some work to do around the multiculturalism mosaic piece. As a person of color in a very white environment out here in Victoria, I think there's still some work to be done. So I would just caution that as wonderful as I think Canada is, I think there's a little resting on laurels that happens around, like, we got it good, we're so good, when there's still always, for all of us, more work to do around welcoming those that are different, around welcoming those that have lived lives that we will never completely or fully understand. So there's always more work to be done. So what do? I keep doing my homework. I keep doing my digging. I do as much watching and looking at CBC and local news and Canadian things and reading Canadian books. But I just want to put that little thing there. There's still more work to be done for Canadians as well. It's not just the folks in the States who have race problems, okay? They have the gun problem added to it, which is a big problem, but there's some race stuff up here, too. Okay?
The ministers received several questions about balancing ministry and parenthood. One was phrased this way: are you able to have sufficient time as a family that is not squeezed in between your ministerial duties? Reverend Melora?
No. But I know we're not alone. It seems to be the constant struggle for working parents, how to balance work and family life. There never seems to be enough time for either. Shauna and I feel this pressure, and we're only supposed to be working half-time each. My heart goes out to families in which two parents work full-time, or a single parent works full-time. Part of the struggle with ministry and with parenthood is that they are both areas in which you can always do more. You can always spend more time with your child. You can always spend more time improving church systems or reaching out to parishioners or answering email or editing and re-editing a sermon. In parenthood and ministry, you can always do more than what you are doing, which means you risk feeling like you're not doing enough of either. Shauna and I remember talking to a well-respected retired UU minister, Reverend Carl Scovel, who told us that when he was working, he always felt torn. He never felt like he was being a good enough parent or a good enough minister. It makes me wonder if the challenge then is to shift one's internal measures so that good enough is good enough. Also, I suspect that it might be more readily achieved if one were able to be fully present as one's best self in whatever one is doing, work or parenting. It is so easy for me to slip into being only half present, thinking through work issues in my head while I'm multitasking chores at home when I'm supposed to be spending time with my children. It's something I'm thinking of focusing on when we're on sabbatical. I suspect that if I invested more time in developing a regular spiritual practice, I could improve my ability to be fully present in any given moment. That is, I might not be able to improve the quantity of my presence, but maybe I can improve the quality of my presence. That's my goal, anyway, to develop a spiritual practice that helps me to bring my full, grounded presence to each moment I'm with my children and each moment I'm doing ministry. I'll let you know how it goes after sabbatical. I should note, by the way, that one of the questions on this topic asked what the congregation can do to support us in this challenge of balancing work and family. I'm getting a little teary because my answer is you already do. The fact that you are sensitive enough to the issue to even ask the question is a sign of this support. You are respectful of our Mondays off. You are understanding when we limit the number of evening social events that we attend as a family. You gave us mat leave without blinking an eye. Go on, you said. We'll be fine. And then when we go on study leave or holiday or sabbatical, you send us off with enthusiastic encouragement and good wishes. Have a good time. Come back refreshed. Every minister parent should be so lucky. Thank you.
Reverend Shauna, the last question today is, do you feel satisfied that your whole self is represented in your work?
Ooh, you guys like that one, huh? I heard a little buzz, like, ooh, yeah, I like that. What's she gonna say now? And my answer is yes and no. I can't imagine a vocation in which you have to be more fully yourself than ministry. I can't wake up any morning and just phone it in and be like, well, I don't really feel like showing up today. Or be disingenuous and try to be somebody else being a minister. That was one of the biggest lessons I learned when I was in ministerial formation, as I was trying to be a minister, and I realized I had to be Shauna being a minister. I couldn't be somebody else being a minister. I can't be shallow. I can't be disingenuous. I can't pretend to be somebody else. I have to be deeply invested, and I am. And I have to have my passions here, and I do. So in that way, absolutely my whole self is present in what I do in ministry. The no side of it is there's more to me than my role. Right? Right after we finished work here, I went to go visit a college friend of mine who's known me for 25 years. And if he saw me up here right now, I think he would say, absolutely, Shauna is right there. And there's some things about her, some aspects to her that I know as her buddy that is not what you see in her public persona, right? That there is a me that is outside of my role, even though I'm deeply invested in my role. I think of it as kind of the completely unguarded me. The completely unguarded me that when I'm not working, when I'm not on the clock, when I'm just hanging out, that's the me that you don't see in the role. But the me who loves poetry, who loves jazz, who's fully invested in being a minister, you see her every single day that you encounter me. That's the whole, and that is a whole self, right? Those of you who came to the Jazz Vespers, and especially the one where I was singing the Ellington, I couldn't have been more in a room than that's probably the most I've been present in my whole life, was singing Come Sunday, because I felt that in the deepest part of myself. So, yes and no.
You asked us so many interesting questions. It was really hard for us to not have time to answer them all. We invite you to hold on to your unanswered questions and any new ones that may have occurred over the course of this service, and bring them to our new Coffee with the Ministers event. As you'll read in the September newsletter, we are trying out an informal after-church gathering where we can answer questions and also listen to your own insights and stories. Mark your calendars for Coffee with the Ministers, noon to 1, on September 18 and October 23.
And now to close our time together today, you asked about our whole selves, but I hope that this is a place where your whole selves are each and every time you enter this space. Your deep sadness, your elated joys, your places of unknowing, your places of certainty, your places where you feel so unique and special and different, and those places where you know that you are one small part of a much larger, expansive whole that you will never fully understand. This is that place where you are invited to bring your whole self. And so may we make this place a place where you will always feel fully welcome, fully at home, and therefore then able to go out into this world and invite others to do the same. May that always be so, this day and every day.